Alcoholics Anonymous has changed my life a lot. I started off as a small child, and I was born into a pretty normal family. My mom and dad are still married. They've been married 54 years, and my sisters, we still speak, which is really, there's some stuff in Alcoholics Anonymous I've heard. It doesn't fit my family very well, and that's cool because I have my own story. My granddad was an alcoholic, and I drank really well with him down in the basement. And I learned to watch for signs in my life, and I really didn't want to be an alcoholic. This wasn't the thing that I signed up for. I did a lot of powdered alcohol in my lifetime, and that powdered alcohol ended up causing me some problems that I went to a drug treatment program when I was in 10th grade, and then I got busted for conspiracy to distribute cocaine when I was like 25, and then I got busted for possession of cocaine, so you might have guessed I did a little cocaine. But all of those telltale signs that there was sort of like this problem in my life, I didn't really notice because I was just having a good time. And, you guys were, I didn't know about you guys yet. And I also didn't think that the world, really had it going on. I knew what was right. And back when I was, much younger before I started doing drugs, I also had a lot of the ism already present in my life. And as I've looked back, I can really see that nothing was enough, and I needed something outside of me to make me feel like I belonged. And I was a born-again Christian for a while when I was in junior high, and didn't really know why I was there other than the band was cool, and I hung out with them and got to get away from the family, which was, my dad was in the Army, and he was a little, in control. And I picked up a few of those control issues, and I try to stomp on them on a regular basis in my life today. I moved to Los Angeles, and that was where I got busted the second time for cocaine, and I stopped doing all drugs and started drinking a lot and driving home like this, and that's when I drank alcoholically quite well on Wednesday evenings. And I was able to get through that process without going to jail again. I went through drug diversion, and they taught me a lot about my drug use, and they didn't mention alcohol a lot, and I didn't think that was the problem. And I also started getting, really into some other things, and my life got really unmanageable, really, really unmanageable. I got sober the first time, and that was because I had a boyfriend that needed to come home from his drug treatment place to a sober environment, and that lasted 2.5 years. And then I had 8 bourbon and 7 with my mom and dad, and I didn't get drunk, and I didn't finish the bottle, and I didn't drink the next day. And 3 months later, I had convinced myself that I wasn't an alcoholic, because I didn't do all of those things, and I probably wasn't a drug addict. And I broke out in a 7-month cocaine run that ended up with a different boyfriend being arrested out front of my house while he was in a Xanax blackout, and I was, there was a little drama going on. And, and that time when I got sober, I went to a bunch of meetings and I relapsed, and I went to a bunch of meetings and relapsed, and I relapsed probably about 20 times. And I went to this meeting and I says, I don't know how to stay sober. I've been trying and trying, and I just give up. And this guy came up to me after the meeting and he says, "That's great. Now you can let God do it." And I went home that night and I prayed, and I haven't had to have a drink or a drug since then. And I don't understand the difference between me doing it with God's help and God doing it, and I don't need to understand. All I know is that if I keep coming to these meetings and I keep working the steps and keep living my life the way that I've been taught in Alcoholics Anonymous, I'll stay sober. And that's on God. That's not on Dave, because Dave's thinking will just get Dave into trouble. And, you know, these sober vacations have changed my life. I don't know how to go on vacation, and I've learned to go on vacation. And actually, today I didn't do anything. I went to the beach, and I just hung out. And then Constance walked up to me and asked me to lead the meeting. And, you know, the grace of God, it is an amazing thing, and I am ever, ever so grateful for all of you teaching me what I've needed to learn to get to this point in my life. And I look forward to learning a lot more and teaching some other people as well. And thanks for letting me share. Our speaker for this evening is Bobby L.
My name is Bobby Coyle. I'm an alcoholic. Can you hear me out there? How's that? How's that? That okay? This is the right one, right? Okay. I'll just have to yell like I'm in a crowded bar. My name is Bobby Coyle. I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank Steve and Constance for their very, very generous invitation to come down here for this week. My sobriety date is June 2nd, 1988. My home group is the McKean Street Miracle Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. We meet at St. Agnes Hospital, Broad and McKean Street in South Philadelphia, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday nights at 7 o'clock. If you're ever in the neighborhood, please stop by. We'd love to have you. We'll wait for cheesesteaks afterwards. Before I start, I'd like to congratulations and props to my newfound friends from New England. We watched the game here on Sunday night, and I'm glad I'm here. You know, it was a good game, and you guys have a great team. Congratulations. You know, and that's growth, because almost 20 years ago, we'd probably been fighting over a stupid football game. Chapter 5 is real clear. I am supposed to tell you in a general way what my life was like as an active alcoholic, what happened to me, and what my life is like today as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was born and raised in a very blue-collar ethnic neighborhood in Philadelphia. I'm the third oldest out of 8. Small family. Well, my father was one of 12, and my mother was one of 10, so I guess they decided to cut back. I never felt a part of. You know, we lived in a small three-bedroom row home. And a row home, I lived in a very old neighborhood, I guess, and it's been gentrified recently, and the yuppies would call them townhouses, but we called them row homes. And it's a small three-bedroom row home, and I never felt a part of, and that's pretty tough to do. Like, you had your parents in one room, the four boys in one room, and the four girls in the other. But I never felt a part of. And that would be true even to early recovery. I never felt a part of, and I always tried to make that connection. There was no booze at all in my house growing up. My father did not drink, and my mother could not drink, besides being pregnant for almost 10 years. It is. You know, there's 8 of us within like a 10-year span. I got a sister 11 months older than me, and I am 11 months older than my next sister. Irish octuplets, I guess we are. But we had no booze. My dad didn't drink. My mom couldn't drink. And when my mom also suffered from a history of mental illness and abused prescription medication, so there was no booze at all in the house. But my grandparents lived around the corner from us, my father's parents, and they had a bar in their basement. And that's where all the family functions were held, the graduations, the christenings, and the parties and things like that. And that's where I had my very first drink. I love my grandparents. My grandparents were immigrants, as they spoke kind of funny. But I guess if you come to my neighborhood, a lot of people may speak kind of funny. But they just had great parties. And I loved the music, and I loved all the everything that went on there. I did not get drunk the first time I drank. I was just a kid. But what I remember was, it was Ballantine beer. And I remember I was running around the bar, the basement bar, you know, finishing off the half empties. Or the half fulls, I guess it all depends on your perception. But I was polishing off the half empties, and my uncles were saying, look at him, look at Bobby. And that's what I craved, the attention. I remember that Ballantyne beer because I remember going up to Connie Mack Stadium with my father. Ballantyne used to sponsor the Phillies, and they had that old scoreboard in right center field. And, you know, growing up in my neighborhood, it's like the same anywhere else. Probably, I've been talking to my friends from Boston. I mean, we're quite similar, you know. It's very blue-collar, very ethnic, a lot of different neighborhoods. We're both walked down a bond by our friends from New York. But us and Boston got a lot in common. So it's the same story, it's just the names change. And my drinking really took off kind of in high school. And right away, I felt kind of different. See, most of the kids in the neighborhood went to the local diocese in high school, and that's where I wanted to go. But my parents knew, you know, they valued education, they being first generation, so they wanted to make sure that we got educated. So they sent me to a private Jesuit high school in North Philadelphia. And right away I felt kind of different because most of the kids who went to this school were from affluent families from the suburbs. It was just me and a couple of the dirtballs in the neighborhood who went there. And right away we had a reputation because we used to walk to this school, and this school was in a pretty rough neighborhood. And these kids, it was their first introduction to the inner city. So as they were getting dropped off by their parents in their luxury automobiles, me and the guys from the neighborhood were inside robbing their lockers. And I knew that was wrong. I had the values instilled in me by the nuns as a kid and by my parents. But again, the need for me to be accepted outweighed anything else. And I had a lot of nicknames. One of those nicknames was Crazy Coil. And I would do things, and I knew they were wrong, and I felt uncomfortable doing it. But I did it anyway, because the need for me to be accepted by you outweighed anything else, you know? And I remember it was my freshman year at the prep. It was football season. It was an away game. There was drinking. There was fighting. There was police activity. It was fun. And I remember the first day back to school, we all had to go sit at the disciplinarian. And he had us all lined up outside his office. There was about 10 of us. They were all upperclassmen. It was just me and another kid from the neighborhood. We were the only two freshmen. And he made a beeline. He came right up to us. He said, "What's with you guys? You're getting this jackpot already? You're only here like 2 weeks. And I just shrugged my shoulders and said, "You know, Father, just one of them things, you know?" And what it was, it didn't take me long along the signs up situations. I didn't know. I knew who was who. Like, even though I did kind of well academically, I didn't hang out with the AP kids. And I didn't play football. I didn't hang out with the athletes. And, you know, I found out my short week and a half there, I found out who was drinking and who was in other things. And that's who I hung out with. And that would be the story of my life. You know, I remember, my junior year, this school, like I said, is a real rough area. It's on the corner of 17th and Girard. And 3 blocks away is the subway. Now, a lot of these kids, at the end of the day, they used to take the trolley car to 3 blocks to catch the subway. They was afraid to walk through the neighborhood. Well, 2 blocks away, on the corner of 15th and Girard, there was a bar called the Ebony Showcase Lounge. And when I was a junior, I was a regular at the Ebony. And I went there for a couple of different reasons. You know, they had dancers and they had cold beer and things like that. But you know what? Me and the guys from the neighborhood would stroll out the Girard Avenue and sit at the bar to show how tough we were. You know, we had this legend, this reputation to keep up in school. And I can now tell you, every time I strolled out Girard Avenue and I sat in the bar, I ordered a drink, I was terrified. But I couldn't let anybody else know. You know, it's about playing the role. When it came time to graduate from the prep, I really had no desire to further my education. And that kind of ticked my parents off because I knew I couldn't stay home because there'd be hell to catch. And like I said, they made a lot of sacrifices to send me and my brothers and sisters to private school. So I knew I couldn't stay home, but I knew I wasn't going to go to school. And I couldn't get an apartment. I had no money. I had no job skills. The only thing that I thought that my only alternative was to enlist in the service. And that really wasn't a bright move back then because nobody else was going. The military wasn't popular, but I enlisted. And I wound up getting sent overseas, and I spent 13 months overseas, and that's when my drinking really took off. I never messed around with other substances in my life up to this point. I never even smoked a joint. I knew a lot of guys from my neighborhood who had gone over and got whacked on certain things, and I had a fear of that. But I definitely had a drinking problem before I went over. I was there a couple months, and several good friends of mine got killed, and I didn't know how to handle that. Because you know what? In my family, we didn't talk about nothing. It was all surface stuff. And once you moved out of the house, you were no longer privy to the secrets of the family. And if you stayed in the house, everything stayed inside you. And that's not a shot at my folks. I mean, that's just the way it was. We didn't talk about nothing. But I knew booze numbed the pain, and that's what I did. And I didn't distinguish myself in the service, and nor did I get in any jackpots. I gave the bare minimum effort required to get by. Like, mediocrity was my goal. And I was somewhat okay with that, you know? I just wanted to sneak behind. I didn't want any attention, good or bad. I just wanted to slide by and hope that you didn't even notice me. When my tour was up, I came home. I wound up taking a couple civil service exams, and I enrolled in school. I went to St. Joe's. And I was there, and the same thing at school. Like, I wasn't setting the world on fire. and not on the dean's list, but I wasn't failing out either, just given the bare minimum effort required to get by. And I remember at the end of the spring semester, it's in May, and one of the guys from the neighborhood called me up. He said, "Bobby, the Phillies are playing tomorrow, one of those businessman specials, like a weekday, like a Tuesday, 12 o'clock game. They said, would you want to go down to the game?" I said, "Sure, like I'll cut class." They wasn't going to miss me in the classroom. So me and four other guys went down to the game, and the Phillies have since moved. They're playing at Vet Stadium down in South Philadelphia. And this day is a day in May, but it's an unusually warm day. And I'm up at the 700 level drinking that cheap, watered-down beer. And I'm talking to the guys, and I said, "You know what?" I said, "I'm going to run down the field and meet one of the players." And they kind of shrugged me off because another nickname I had was Bullshit Bob. I was like, "I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that, I did that." I didn't do nothing. I just made stories. That's what I did. But I was up there drinking, and I finagled my way down. And they used to have an old picnic area down in there, and I went down to the picnic area, and I jumped over the fence, and I ran out in the field. And I'm running around like maybe, you know, a couple minutes, and it seems like about 10. I'm running around like a screwball. And I remember the San Diego Padres were in town, and Dave Winfield was a right fielder for the Padres. And I went out, and I shook his hand. I said, "Hi, Dave, how you doing?" And he looked at me. He said, "Brother," he said, "what are you doing out here?" And from behind him, like he was a big dude, behind him I saw the guards coming. I said, "Dave, I got to go now." So I start running towards the infield. I want to slide into second base. And as I was running towards the infield, there was more guards coming from the third base side. And I knew I couldn't do that because if I slid into second, I'd get caught. So I turned around. I start walking towards first base. And I'm as close as the guard probably as Dick and I are right now. Like I'm walking, like to give myself up. At the last second, I deked the guy and I ran out in the outfield. Like I said, I'm running around. It seems like about 10 minutes, but it's probably about two or three. Up on the old school board up there, they put Mr. Excitement. I mean, they couldn't catch it. I mean, I was just home from the service. I'm in good shape. I'm juking, diving, doing all this stuff. All of a sudden, I stop. I'm out of breath. I'm about to get sick, you know. The fence is 12 feet high. I got nowhere to go. So I just stop. I stop out in the outfield, and they surround me, and they take me off the field. I get a standing ovation from 37,000 people. Tug McGraw was in the bullpen for the Phillies, and he gave me the thumbs up. Way to go. Now, I knew I was going to get a beating from the guards because I made them look so stupid. That was okay. They could have beat on me all day long because I knew. Now, this would be a type of story that I would make up, right? But I had them four guys in the neighborhood that were my witnesses. I knew I'd be a legend in the neighborhood. I could drink for free for the rest of the week. I know that. Just as I was about to get my beating, a Philadelphia police lieutenant showed up. He said, "What's the matter with you?" He said, "Are you drunk? Are you high?" I said, "No, I'm just happy. Just happy to be here." He said, "Well, you better get your happy ass out of the stadium." And that was important. Not only did he save me from getting beaten, but he also saved me from getting arrested. And that was important because one of them civil service exams panned out not that long afterwards, and I got hired by the Philadelphia Police Department. They was hiring anybody back then. We had a mayor at the time, a guy by the name of Frank Rizzo. Frank was a former cop, and there was 8,500 of us, and we were nothing but a gang of badges. It was, man, there were good times. I'm not even old enough to drink at this point. I'm still a couple months shy. 21's always been the drinking age in Pennsylvania. At that time, the drinking age in Jersey was 18. And where I lived in Philadelphia, I could be across the bridge in Jersey quicker than I could be in other parts of Philadelphia. So we used to go over the bridge and drink. But once I got on the job, I could go with doors open. I could do whatever I want to do. I spent my first 10 years of my career in North Philadelphia where I would see the ravages of alcoholism and drug addiction day in, day out. And at the end of the day, I would go with guys in the squad. We'd go out and just drink. And I saw things on the job that bothered me, but I didn't want to tell my coworkers that because I didn't want to be thought less than. I wanted to be one of the boys. To the point where I even engaged in behaviors I knew it was wrong. I knew it was wrong, again, by the values instilled in me, by the nuns, by the Jesuits, by my parents. And in my gut, I knew it was wrong, but I did it anyway because the need for me to be accepted by my coworkers outweighed anything else. And it was nuts. And you know what? The handwriting was on the wall from an early go. And I was the last guy to figure it out. I remember one day I was at work and my supervisor pulled me off to the side. He said, "You know what, kid?" He said, "You're smart. You're going to go places. That booze is going to mess you up in one ear and out the other." I had an uncle on the job and we were at a family function. He pulled me off to the side. He said, "Bobby, I'm hearing stories about you. You're going to get yourself in a jackpot. You better take it easy. In one ear and out the other." Several years later, on two separate occasions, I ran into my uncle and that supervisor in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I realized at that point that they were trying to 12-step me. And I remember talking to my uncle, Jimmy. I said, Jimmy, how come you didn't tell me? He just smiled. He said, Bobby, you just weren't ready yet. Which just goes to show you that all the drinking and all the activity that went with it were necessary for me to hit my bottom. I knew about Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I made my first meeting in 1979. I really didn't go out because I never came in. But I'll tell you what happened. I showed up at work one day, and on our job, we had a counseling unit, part of the job. And one day I showed up, one of my coworkers was drunk, he was just out of his mind. And the supervisor said, take this guy up to the unit, he's going to be detailed there for the day. I said, okay. So I drive up, and this was a little house that sat in the park. And I come down the driveway, and there was a guy sitting on the porch. His name was Eddie M. And I said, Eddie, I'm dropping this guy off. He's detailed here for the day. I'll be back at 4 o'clock to pick him up. He looked me dead in the eye. He said, kid, do you want to come in? I said, no, I don't. I was insulted that he even asked me. Because I know what alcoholics were. Alcoholics were you older guys, you married guys, you guys with the three heads, these poor souls I was dealing in, day out. I didn't have a problem with alcohol. I was a beer drinker, and there was no way that you could be an alcoholic drinking beer. I mean, the only time I drank hard liquor was like on St. Patty's Day or New Year's Day or payday, but I was a beer drinker. You know? And you couldn't be an alcoholic drinking beer, you know? I need to back up a little bit. That story I talk about running on the field, I tell that story for a couple of different reasons. One, it's true. I got those four guys in the neighborhood that would back me up. Secondly, though, you know what? It's the only funny story I got. I wasn't a funny guy. I wasn't an athlete. I wasn't a lover. I was none of that stuff. I was a lying, thieving, stinking, falling down, violent, drunk from the very beginning. If I hung around you, you had something I wanted. I used and abused every person I came in contact with. I was nasty. I really was. And thirdly, you know what? I was a blackout drinker from the very first start. You know, this is one of the only few stories I actually do remember. I remember from a young age showing up on the corner, and the guys would tell me, things I did the night before. Oh, Bobby, you were nuts. You did this, you know. And a couple hours later, I would be telling those stories over like I remember them, you know. I was a blackout drinker from the very first start. So I'm working, and even though I'm doing very well in my career because I'm nuts, but my personal life is a shambles, you know. And I was 24 years old, and I shot and killed a 15-year-old kid in the line of work in a situation that just couldn't be avoided. And I used that as an excuse to crawl in a bottle, and that's what I did for the next 3 years. I wound up getting sober when I was 27, you know. And those 3 years were just ugly. Drinking took me to a lot of my nevers, and one of those nevers was the use of other substances. I wound up getting promoted and transferred and put in this particular unit, and I was put in a position where I thought I needed to do other substances. And because I was drinking, my judgment was impaired, and I got involved in other substances. My use of other substances is very short. It only lasted about 17 months, but it caused a lot of problems for me and a lot of other people. And out of respect to the fifth tradition, that's all I need to talk about that stuff. You know, it just went with the territory. And you know what? At the end of my drinking, man, it was ugly. And you know what? I knew it. I remember one day I'm sitting home from work, and there was an article in the Daily News. At the bottom it said alcohol problems, drug problems, depression, thoughts of suicide, marital problems. I was 4 out of 5. I was single. And I'm sure if I was married, I'd been batting 1,000. And they talk about the moment of clarity, but as soon as it came, it quickly left. But something made me cut that ad out, and I stuck it in my wallet, and I continued on drinking. It was Memorial Day weekend, 1988. I was sitting in the bar, guys that I worked with, and it was like a planning meeting. Some of the guys I worked with were in some serious trouble, and we were supposed to come up with some sort of plan, and we just wound up getting drunk, just like everything else. Towards the end of the day, though, one of the guys said that he needed to go home for one reason or the other, and I decided that I would drive him home. I did not think that I was as drunk as he was, and he thought this was a good idea. So I got in my car, a city car, and I was always a show-off. I was always an arrogant guy, and it's pretty tough to easy to show off, especially with things that don't belong to you. So I was going to show off my driving skills in front of my coworker. I'm driving at the street, and about a block and a half, 2 blocks away, I see a kid riding towards me on a bicycle. And this was a very narrow one-way street in the city. And so I decided I was going to play chicken with this kid. And unfortunately, at the last second, we both turned in the same direction. I ran this kid over. As he lied bleeding on the hood of my car, I got out of my car on my nightstick and was going to beat this kid because I thought he was going to milk me in the city for an insurance claim. The guy that I was with prevented me from doing that. I took this kid off the hood of my car, threw him off the side of the street like a piece of trash. I pulled this crumpled bicycle from underneath my car, threw that off the side of the street like a piece of trash. I drove back to the bar, I made some sort of smart-aleck remark, and I continued on drinking. When I came to the next day, I realized I was in serious, serious trouble, but I didn't think anybody would help me because I was such a creep. I didn't know what to do. So I got a bottle of liquor, a case of beer, and some other substances, and I checked into a hotel with the intention to consume all this stuff to build up the courage and my life. And 3 days later, they're knocking on the hotel door to kick me out. And at this point, all the booze and all the other substances are gone. And I couldn't shoot myself because at this point I was suspended from my job. I no longer had access to my weapon. So I walked over to the window, and I opened up the window. I was going to jump out the window. And when I opened up the window, I was on the fifth floor. And I remembered I was scared of heights. I made 23 jumps in the service. I never overcame my fear of heights. So what I did then, I went in the bathroom and I filled the bathtub up with water and I had a blow dryer and I was going to pull the blow dryer in the tub to make it appear an accidental electrocution. But every time I would pull the blow dryer into the tub, it would come unplugged. I was about a foot and a half short on cord and I got 1 foot in the tub and I'm leaning trying to do it. And it's okay to laugh. I don't want to forget the pain I was in that day, but it was like the scene out of that Woody Allen movie where he couldn't even kill himself. So the only other tool that I had left was my car. So I took one last spin through my neighborhood. I started up at the Falls Bridge, and I come down the East River Drive, which is a winding road along the Schuylkill River. And I come down the drive, and my plan was to go on a head-on collision, cause a head-on collision to end my life. And I handled enough jobs like that, and I knew that I would be successful if I did that. Now, this was like a Wednesday or a Thursday around 10:30 in the morning, and that would be important because if I did this in any other time of the day, I would have probably been successful because there was very little traffic. And the speed limit on the drive is 25, and I'm doing probably about 40. And I'm hungover, and I'm cooked, and I'm just crying. And I'm coming down the drive, and I now know it was my higher power was looking out after me, but, 17 years ago, I didn't know that. And something hit me emotionally. I really didn't want to go into oncoming traffic because, you know what, as much as I needed my pain to end, I didn't want to cause pain to anybody else. I mean, I handled jobs like that. I had to knock on people's doors and tell them that, their loved one was involved in an automobile accident. And I've seen people age right in front of my eyes, and it's just a terrible thing to do. And I didn't want to do that, but I knew I needed to end my pain. So I decided I would wrap myself around a tree, and we got these big old trees along the drive. And I knew that would work because I handled jobs like that, and I knew that would definitely do the trick too. All of a sudden, I just started crying. And I pulled over at the end of the East River Drive, and it's Boathouse Row. And I sat behind on the wheel of my car, and I cried like a baby for about 10 minutes. And I reached into my glove box, and the glove box was my wallet. And inside that wallet was that ad that I cut out of Daily News about 6 weeks before. And it's no longer there, but at the end of the last boathouse is one of those old glass and closed phone booths. And I walked over to the phone booth, and I dialed the phone number that I had on that ad. And the woman who answered the phone, I spoke to this woman like I spoke to no one in my life before. I told her the truth. I lied about everything. I told this woman the truth. I just told her everything that was going on in my life, and I was crying, and just my life was a shambles, and this was happening. And God bless her, she listened patiently. And she said, listen, why don't you drive over to Hahnemann Hospital? Somebody would be waiting to talk to you. And that was like about a 4 or 5 minute drive. And I rode over there, and somebody was waiting to talk to me. They admitted me to their 10th floor psychiatric unit. And they kept me there for about 3 or 4 days. It got me kind of stabilized. And from there, I got transferred to the VA hospital out in West Philadelphia. And I spent about 6 weeks in their flight deck, and they got me kind of squared away. And then I got transferred to the VA hospital out in Coatesville, where I spent a number of weeks in their flight deck before getting put into an alcohol and drug ward. When I pulled over that day and made that phone call, Alcoholics Anonymous was the furthest thing from my mind. I didn't think I had a problem with alcohol. I was a beer drinker. There's no way you could be an alcoholic drinking beer. I thought my problem was these other substances. If I left this stuff alone, I'd be okay. I thought maybe I was mentally ill, and I inherited that from my mother. Maybe I had this stress disorder they're now talking about. I got this from my job. I got this from experience in the service. Maybe it's the fact that it's a neighborhood I live in. Maybe it's the fact that I'm a mummer. I mean, it got to be something, but it can't be alcoholic because I don't drink alcohol. I just drink beer. So I remember when I got put into the alcohol and drug ward at the VA hospital, I'm there probably about 20 or 30 minutes, scouting to get the lay of the land. At this point, I have probably about 10 weeks under my belt. And I walk into the day room, and in the day room, up on the wall, they got the large window shades of the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. And I go up through the steps, and I zip through them. I got about 6 of them done. And I see the amends. I said, they're screwed. That doesn't apply to me. Well, what happened later that night, two men came up, and I would later find out that they were part of the treatment facility committee. Did not know that then. And these guys came up, and they carried the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. The moment that the speaker said something about his background that I couldn't relate to, did not identify with, or just plain didn't like, I immediately tuned him out. I was too busy listening to the messenger and not the message. But now I'm getting a little cocky, and I'm eyeing up my peers, you know? And I'm not bad as these guys. A lot of these guys got legal problems. I really didn't have any problems at this point. The fact that I had a gold shield on my back pocket, maybe it had something to do with that. A lot of these guys had marital problems. They had kids who hated them and spouses and didn't talk to them. I didn't have that problem. The fact was, I've never been married. I don't have any kids, so that may have been something to do with that. But I was looking for the differences and not the similarities between me and these other guys. But what bothered me the most, without question, was at the end of the meeting, everyone got in a circle and said the Lord's Prayer. If this is what you people are about, then I don't want nothing to do with you because I hated God. And I know they're strong words, but I hated God, and I hated him for a number of reasons. Most importantly, my mom had a mental illness, and among many other things, she was like a fundamentalist, you know. And there were pictures and radio programs, and she had, you know, candles all throughout the house, and she was involved in a charismatic movement. She believed she could speak in tongues and all that other stuff. I was 15 years old. I came home from school one day. I'm in the house, I don't know, about 15, 20 minutes. And I came across my mother. My mother had slit her wrist. And I remember she looked up at me. She said, "Bobby, help me." And I looked down at her and said, "Good for you." And I walked out. And I got an older guy to go to the state store to get me a bottle of wine. And I drank the wine. And I stayed out. And I came home later that night. My dad had told me what happened. I acted surprised. I said, "Oh, yeah, how about that?" So that happened when I was 15. I didn't get sober until I was 27. That's 12 years of hate of God. And it'll be a few more years before I would address this issue. So I broke away from the group. I wouldn't say the prayer. You know, there was a nurse there, and I'm about to say this, and please, it's not to get a joke. She had to be a member of Al-Anon, man. She was a beautiful lady, and she saw all through my BS. And she came up to me afterwards, and she said, "You know what? The only way you're going to make it is you're going to need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I need to tell you that's the best piece of advice I got." The VA helped me with a lot of things I had going on in my life. Without question, they were a tremendous help. But I would get my recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to AA every single day. Sometimes two or three, depending what shift I was working. And I would get there late, and I would leave early. If I walked into a big book meeting or step meeting that was strictly by accident, I would leave at the break. I had something more important to do. I don't drink coffee, never have, so I don't make it. I don't smoke cigarettes, never have, so I don't empty any ashtrays. God forbid tradition meetings, rules. In my line of work, we love to enforce them. We don't like to follow them. They're for other people. But I made meetings every single day, and I was crazy as a bed bug. I was sober, I guess, about 8-9 months. I'm sitting in this bar because they sold real good roast beef. And I'm drinking seltzer out of a rock glass, you know. And a couple guys from the neighborhood came in, and for some one reason or another, they found it necessary just like to break my stones. And I know why it was, because I was always an arrogant guy. And you know what, I had a lot of attention. I used to take advantage of that. But you know what, because of my incident 6 months before, there was a lot of negative attention. So they felt it necessary to knock me down a couple pegs, and I probably deserved it. So that's why I was in that bar. It wasn't because they sell good roast beef. I wanted to let people know that I was back. Don't believe what you read. You know, things are cool, everything's all right now, you know, things are going okay. It was a mistake. Words, you know, one thing led to another, and I just had enough, and I stood up and I punched this guy right in the face with the mug, and I cut him severely. He bled like a pig. And I remember the guys who came who handled the job. Like, I knew one of the guys. He looked at me and said, "What the hell are you doing here?" I told him what was going on. He said, "Man, get out of here." And I learned my lessons about people, places, and things. And I've since found a place that sells real good roast beef without being in that type of environment, you know. I was sober a year, and I told my story. My home group at that time, that's what you did. You told your story. And I got done, and it was incredible. A thunderous applause. The blind could see, the lame walked. It was a really incredible experience. And they came up, and they patted me on the back and said, "Bobby, you're doing so good." I felt about yay big. I lied during my entire story. My home group at that time, because you can only identify yourself as an alcoholic and only talk about alcohol. You couldn't talk about nothing else. So I identified myself as an alcoholic, and I didn't believe it. In fact, during the course of my story, a bottle of beer appeared in my head. But you guys don't want to hear that. I gave you all the information you want to hear, and I was somewhat on the ball, so I knew how to like retain information, and that's what I did. I gave you all the quotes and did all that other stuff. And they patted me in the back and said, "You're doing so good." And, man, I was nuts. I was nuts. I was sober 23 months. I beat another man with a baseball bat. I forget what step I was working that day. But I swear to God, I was nuts. I swear to God, my home group, we had a cork board, anniversaries of the month, first name, last initial, day of the month, how many years you're celebrating. I swear to God, if Joey A. had 3 years and Bobby C. had two and Joey A. went out, I said, good for him, I move up. I was about time. I thought that's what it was. I swear to God, I had no idea who John Barleycorn was. I was wondering why is everybody blowing this guy's anonymity, you know. Once I found out who John Barleycorn was, I felt so stupid. I mean, here I was so damn bright, it damn near killed me. I was crazy. The guys in the group, though, they knew me. I once said a prayer. And the guys in the group, I was sober a little over a year, and they said, Bobby, you working this weekend? And before I could, like, formulate the lie, it came out. I said, no. They said, good, we're going to retreat this weekend. We're going to take you with us. And you know what? I like these guys, right? But I really didn't like them. Because after the meetings, sometimes they would come up and invite me up. Bobby, we're going out to the diner. I said, nah, I guess I'm better. I got to go. And they said, okay. Then when they wouldn't invite me, I would get mad that they wouldn't invite me. And then when I was waiting around, like hoping for the invite, and if they invite me, I said, no, I can't go. I mean, I was just nuts. I didn't have a sponsor. You know, I was just crazy as a bedbug. So I go on this retreat, and it's funny because I'm in the back seat with a guy on each side of me. It's like role reversal at work. I'm usually driving the car, but here I'm in the back seat, a guy on each side of me. And the closer we get to the retreat house, the bigger the knot my stomach gets. I can't possibly tell these guys what happened about my mom. I mean, I heard some things in AA, but I didn't hear anything like this, and I didn't know how I would be received. And I just couldn't tell them. But the need for me to be accepted by these guys outweighed anything else. Like, these guys were making retreats like on a regular basis, maybe 4 or 5 times a year, and they would come back in a meeting on Sunday night, and they would have this glow about them, and I said, oh, Christ, not again. I would have to go to another meeting on Sunday night because I couldn't hear these guys anymore because they were, like, so much like on the beam. It just bugged me. So I go on this retreat, and then we get there a Friday afternoon. We're there about 45 minutes, and they say, Bobby, we want to introduce you to the retreat master. I said, okay, let's get this over with, right? I go in this little room. They open up this door, and this guy just gives a big old smile. He's my disciplinarian from high school. But not only that, but he was also, I found out, a longtime member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he just hugged me, and he said, man, I knew you had a problem. We start talking. And I'm telling you, it was just an incredible experience. And then we start talking. He said, how long are you sober? And I'm telling him what the deal is. Wants to know where I'm going to meetings. I'm giving him the information. He said, who's your sponsor? I says, I don't have one. Because I'm a pretty bright guy. I knew I could figure this out. And he knew I was a bright guy, too. He said, I strongly suggest you get a sponsor. So I asked my roommate that weekend at the retreat to be my sponsor. Just in case, God forbid, should I ever be questioned again. Yeah, you got a sponsor? Yeah, there he goes, right there. And I never talked to this guy. The only time I talked to him is when I accidentally bumped to him in the meetings. I would see him. He'd say, Bobby, I still got that same phone number. I said, yeah, I'll give you a call. I never called him. Know what I used to do? I used to go to other people. I said, oh, you won't believe this guy. He got me doing this. He wants me to do that. He's nuts. He didn't do nothing. I made it up. He put the hand of AA out there, and I slapped it away, and then I character assassinated the guy to boot. I mean, that's how nuts I was. I remember taking a commitment. I was sober about a year and a half. Me and this other guy from the neighborhood, he was just as nuts as I was. We took this commitment. It was in the basement of the church where I went to grade school. You came down the runway, and the chairs were facing the front of the room. So one week, we got there on Tuesday night, and we changed the chairs. We had them facing the wall. And that really threw people. But no one said nothing. The following week, we just set them the other direction, just facing the opposite way. And I could tell people I was waiting for somebody. You know, we did it on purpose. We wanted to get a response, but no one said anything. The third week, we turned the chairs completely around. So where you came in, instead of being at the back of the room, you were now at the front of the room. That was it. At the end of the meeting, they got like the biggest guys in the group, a couple firemen. They came up, and we always had a little to do with them anyway. A couple of them guys came over, me and this other guy, and they surrounded us and said, listen, you want to set these chairs up next week? You can, but you set them up right and stop knocking this crap over and all this other stuff. But that's just how nuts I was. I was defiant to the core. Even when I sat in meetings, I never got my hand up to share, only to take a shot at somebody. I remember I would go to the men's room or get something to drink and come back, and the seat next to me would be empty. They would sit on the other side of the room. I mean, I was just nuts. I didn't carry the message. I carried the disease. Stone cold sober in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was dying from untreated alcoholism. I was a liar, a thief, and a cheat. I was a creep when it came to the new women. I did everything wrong you could do in AA. The only thing I didn't do, I didn't pick up a drink. And people would pat me on the back and say, "That's okay, Bobby, just don't drink." And I took that as the okay to do whatever the hell I want to do. And I got sicker in the rooms of AA. My second anniversary came, and I didn't celebrate my anniversary. A month after my second anniversary, I went to eat my gun. The same pathetic feeling I had 25 months before, but 25 months before I was loaded with drugs and alcohol. Here I am making regular attendance at meetings in AA, and I was nuts. Wanted to eat my gun, safe to assume my life was unmanageable. There was a guy at this meeting this night, and I know him from my neighborhood. His nickname was Troubles. One of them hard-earned nicknames. Like, he was in and out of jail in the 60s and 70s, but no one called him Troubles to his face because he was a pretty rough guy. So at the end of the meeting, I saw him. I said, "Bobby," I said, "I need some help." I said, "Would you be my sponsor?" He looked me dead in the eye. He said, "Bobby, I've been watching you these past couple years, and I'm sticking my chest out." I said, "Yeah, he must like me." He says, "I need to tell you." He says, "You're full of shit. That's not the response I'm looking for." He's looking at me. He says, "I'm going to be your sponsor under certain conditions. You're going to call me every single day. You're going to go to a big book meeting a week. You're going to go to one-step meeting a week. You're going to go to a men's meeting a week. You're going to get a coffee commitment, and you want to leave them damn women alone." And I'm talking to myself, like, who's he talking to? I have 25 months here. I'm selling the grapevines. Like, I got it going on. But what I did do, I looked him dead in the eye. I said, "Okay, that's what I'm willing to do." And that's the night that I took the first three steps. See, I knew that I was powerless over alcohol. Now, I needed to tell you, I hated everybody. I was just a mess. I hated everybody. But you know who I hated the most? I hated the new guys. Because I remember my very first outside meeting. I spent almost 6 months in the VA hospital. When I got out, my very first meeting, there was a husband and wife speaking. They both had 10 years. The wife had one more date than her husband, and she constantly reminded him of that throughout her story. And there were people saying they had 8 years, and I couldn't believe these people. I thought, you know, maybe you go over to Jersey and drink and keep your Pennsylvania time. I thought maybe... I just couldn't fathom that. But there was a dude from my neighborhood who was there. He was sober like 9 or 10 months, and this dude, he was nuts. And I figured, I knew him. I didn't know anybody else in the room. This guy I knew. And I figured if that's the only reason I came back to AA. I saw this guy, and I figured if he was sober, it had to work for anyone. So that's the only reason I came back. But I was just nuts. And I forget what point I was making. I was nuts, for the sake of it, I was nuts. So I go back to his house, Bobby's, after the house. Oh, I was saying I hated everyone. You know who I hated the most? I hated the guys coming behind me. How dare they get better before me? See, like, I was pretty sharp. Like, I could talk the talk. But you know what? You couldn't fake the glow. I saw these people coming in who were just completely wrecks of human beings. And 6, 8, 10 months later, 12 months later, I see these guys. They're for real. They got the glow. And I wonder why, and I'm mad that they got it before me. But the deal was, they were doing the work that I was afraid to do. And that was the bottom line. I was afraid. You know, I could talk about anger and all that, but I was consumed by fear. I never had the courage to do the right thing. I hid behind a badge. I hid behind a bottle. I never had the courage to do the right thing. I got that courage in Alcoholics Anonymous. I went back to my sponsor's house that night, and we went over the first two steps, and then we got on our knees together and said the third step prayer. And then when I got done, he said, "Bobby, the way we do a third step is we do an inventory. We pick up a paper and pen, and we do this fourth step." And I'm like, whoa, easy does it. Don't want to get well too soon. Because, you know, I mean, I'm going to meetings. I'm hearing people say, whoa, I'm doing this fourth step. I feel like going out. All this stuff stirred up. You know what? I feel like eating my gun. You can't get no further out than that. So I did my inventory. And you know what? It was no big deal. Like, everything I wrote down, I did. It was nothing. It really wasn't that hard. The next step, that was the hard one, the fifth step. But I'm pretty bright, so I called my sponsor up. I said, "Bobby, when I'm going to go on a retreat this week, I'm going to do that fifth step with that priest." And he said, "Good." He said, "When you're done, stop by my house and do it with me." And you know, sometimes you're talking to your sponsor and you wonder, like, deaf or something, you know. And he must have picked up on it. He said, "Bobby," he says, "I understand." He said, "But when you get done, stop by my house and do it with me." And before I could object, he told me, he said, "My job's your sponsor. My role is to walk you through these steps. If I'm going to help you with these character defects, I think I need to know what they are." And the truth was, even though I have God and the church down on the resentment list, and still there, just because I wrote it down, it's still there. The only reason I want to do the fifth step with the priest, because there were a lot of things I was embarrassed about. I was afraid that if I told my sponsor these things, that he would ridicule me, he would pass judgment on me, or even worse, he would break the confidence and tell other people. And I knew that was going to happen with the priest. I never did that fifth step with the priest. I did that fifth step with my sponsor. And those fears I had came out to be unfounded fears. He did none of those things. In fact, you know what he did when I got done? He shared some of his stuff with me, which took away the terminal uniqueness that I thought I was the only guy to have certain things. And I'll be forever grateful for him doing that. See, in the 60s, in a blackout, he had taken someone's life, and he went to jail and paid the price for that. So, and this incident with the kid, it was bothering me, and he shared with me, and I'd just be forever grateful for him doing that. When I got done, steps 6 and 7 for me, you know, character defects. Now, I would go to meetings, 6 and 7 step meetings, I'd hear people talk about these, and I had no clue what the hell they were talking about. I knew when I drank I was a character, but you know what? Once I took my inventory, I found out that I had no character whatsoever. You know, whatever role I abdicated, I was more important to get loaded than anything else. I wasn't a son, I wasn't an employee, I wasn't a brother, I was none of that stuff. I was just a creep. So the sixth step, I became willing. And the seventh step was a prayer. And my sponsor would always say, Bobby, you need to put legs on those prayers. I mean, I can pray all day long. I mean, I got a laundry list of character defects. And one of those is I'm not sometimes the most patient guy in the world. And I can pray, God, please help me be patient, help me be patient. But should I be put in a position during the course of a day and I chose to be impatient or lash out in sarcasm, which is nothing but anger, also referred to as language of the Irish. But if I lash out in sarcasm, that prayer for patience goes right out the window, you know. And I now know that God will do for me what I can't do for myself. But I got to pray, and you know, but it is a program of action. The A step, because I didn't burn my fourth step, half my A step was done, you know. And I had to throw more names down in there, you know. And the ninth step, direct amends. You know, I wanted to do the phone letter, you know, the phone calls and the letters, and my sponsor told me, he said, Bobby, the word would be indirect amends. It says, you didn't rob anybody through the phone or over, you know, hit anybody with a bat through the mail. You need to make direct amends. And I'd like to share two experiences on the ninth step. I was in a meeting about 14, 15 years ago. It was in North Philadelphia. Now, I come down, I'm sitting at this table, and right before the meeting starts, I see this guy walk down the steps. I have not seen this guy since 1977. He is not on my A step, not for any fear or anything else. I just plain forgot, you know, out of sight, out of mind. But as soon as I saw this guy, I recognized him. And so when it gave time to me, I got introduced, I stood up, I looked this guy dead in the eye. I said, my name is Bobby Coyle, and I'm an alcoholic. He nodded, he smiled, then he recognized me. Now, I need to tell you real quick why I use my full name. I know we read the traditions here, and I know a lot of these traditions are top secret stuff, and we're not even going to mention the concepts, but you know, the traditions, a lot of them were somewhat misunderstood, and no more so than this 11th tradition. Like back home, all of a sudden we get sober, it's like we joined the mafia. Yeah. We get nicknames, you know, there's Pepsi George and Jimmy the Coat and Frank the Fox and Bucktooth Mary, and you know, everybody in my neighborhood knew I was a drunk. It was those little telltale signs. They would come outside, they'd catch me, I'd be urinating on their car. My girlfriend throw the clothes out the window. I'm slumped behind the wheel of my car. Everybody knows I'm a raving lunatic drunk. God forbid I get sober and my reputation should be tarnished anyway. The 11th tradition is real clear. At the level of press, radio, and films, that's where we maintain our personal anonymity. That means you will never see my picture in the newspaper or on television or hear my full name on the radio, which happens to be Robert Ignatius Benedict Coyle III. With a moniker like that, you wonder why I drank. Stefala is a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That is the violation of the 11th tradition. In Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, Dr. Bob said when one drunk is anonymous from another drunk, that's a violation of the 11th tradition. He went on to say that anonymity is spiritually inspired and secrecy is spirit inspired. I mean, God forbid, 3 o'clock in the morning, you feel like drinking. What are you going to do? Call information? I'd like to have Frank the Fox's phone number. Or you want to go visit one of these old-timers at the hospital. Say, yeah, what room is Jimmy the Coat in? I mean, if they got a nut ward, that's where you're going to wind up. However, I have no right whatsoever to break anybody else's anonymity. And I was very involved in the area back home. We just choose to use our full name but I have no right whatsoever to break your anonymity. So off that soapbox, back to the meeting, I looked this guy dead in the eye. I said, my name is Bobby Coyle. I'm an alcoholic. He nodded. He recognized me. what I used to do, his name was Bob. And Bob was, I drank with him. And one day we were in a bar, we had an exchange, and he kind of backed down. He was much bigger than I was. And from that point on, whenever I wanted to impress anybody how nuts I was, I would publicly humiliate Bob. It would be the verbal taunts. One day I slapped him, and then one day I even spat on him. I mean, what worse thing can you do to another human being but spit on him, you know? And he didn't do nothing. And I'm not a tough guy, I never was. But I humiliated this guy. So when I got done speaking, I looked Bob dead in the eye, and I told the group what I did. And I said, Bob, I'm truly sorry. And as long as I stay sober, I hope I never treat you and another human being the way I treated you. Because I was told that the ninth step was much more than saying I'm sorry. It's about righting the wrong. And for me, if I owe you money, it's real easy. I go in my pocket, I pay you back, or I go on a payment plan with you. But what about that psychological or emotional damage I cause people? How do I make amends for that? You know? I sat down, I was sober 6 years, I sat down with my father and I told him what happened to my mom. You know? It's probably one of the hardest things I did. You know, my dad, he hugged me, he forgave me. He said, listen, she was just a sick woman. You know? And that's what I need to do, the ninth step. Now, I'd like to tell you another experience in the ninth step. I'm at my home group at this time. It's a Stepping Stone Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I make a motion at the business meeting. It's definitely for the betterment of AA since I made it. I know it. There's discussion. My motion doesn't get seconded, which is baffling because my boy Freddie's in the rooms. Now, I grew up in a neighborhood. There are certain rules, as warped as they are. There's still neighborhood rules. Everyone knows what they are. One of them is, like, you can never date anybody else's ex. I mean, you just don't do that. Secondly, you always cover your boy. Right, wrong, or indifferent. I mean, if he's wrong, you can later pull him off to the side. But at group level, you always cover your boy. It was just a rule. So Freddie probably forgot that rule because he didn't second it, my motion, and my motion went down in flames. I would come to the group. There'd be three or four guys sitting in the room. I would talk to everybody but Freddie. I would completely ignore him. I'm at work one day, a few months after that, one of my coworkers came up to me. He said, Bobby, he said, Freddie Wheels is outside. He wants to take care of some sort of business. I peeked out the window and I saw him. I said, tell him to take his fat ass down to City Hall. He can't do that here. Not that long afterwards, that same coworker called me up, who also happened to be sober. And a coworker called me up. He said, Bobby, he said, Freddie Wheels passed away last night. And he said, the reason I'm calling you is because he always spoke so highly of you. Now, here he was a friend of mine for a lot of years, and as God is my judge, I cannot tell you what that motion was about. That's how petty it was. Here was a guy that was put in my path many, many times. I chose not to take advantage of making the amends. And the moment that that co-worker told me, he said, Bobby, because he always spoke so highly of you, I felt about yay big. And I've been praying for Freddie ever since. And that's two experiences on the ninth step. See that key word at the end of the ninth step? Wherever possible. I used to thought that said whenever possible. And you know, for alcoholics, at least for me, I'll speak for myself, it's never the right time because I'm too busy, easy, doesn't it? Keeping it simple, you know? Assuming that people are always going to be put my path. That guy was put my path many, many times. I chose not to make amends. The first experience with Bob, I made amends and I reaped the rewards. The second experience, I didn't take advantage of the situation. I had numerous occasions and I paid the price. You know, the 10th step is nothing but 4 through 9 on a regular basis. Now, if I'm going to stand up here and tell you I do a 10th step every day, that's not true. I used to also say, if I'm not doing the 10th step, no one knows but me. That's also not true. Because when I'm not practicing these principles, I operate in nitwit mode. Should you cross my path in nitwit mode, you also are affected. You know, and it's amazing because you know what? You know the old saying, you can't miss what you never had? Well, I never had peace of mind, so I never missed it. In early recovery, I would go to meetings, especially those serene meetings, which scared the hell out of me. I would get my hand up to add my insanity, and then I'd just sit back and watch the show. And I said, man, this is good. But you know what? I no longer live like that. In fact, I'm uncomfortable living like that. I don't want to have all that stuff. But I'm human. I make mistakes. And sometimes I'm off the beam. But at least I know what to do. I need to get back on the beam. And I'm pretty consistent with the 10th step. Sometimes 4, 5, 6 times a week, other times 2 or 3 times a week. And every time that I get in some sort of jackpot, I'm able to laugh at myself most times because I know it's me, you know. It's a spiritual maintenance I got to keep on a daily basis. The 11th step through prayer and meditation, I start praying and meditating through the steps. Even though, again, my resentment towards God and church, slowly but surely it was been removed. See, the problem wasn't the church. just like the problem wasn't the Air Force, it wasn't the police department, it wasn't the neighborhood I lived in, you know, it wasn't my mom. The problem was Bobby Coyle. I was the problem long before I picked up a drink. Definitely the problem when I drank, and in early recovery, I was still the problem. I needed to take a look at myself. The 12 step, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. I did the steps, I had a spiritual awakening. Now, I didn't see any burning bush or lightning bolts, or I haven't heard any voices. In fact, it's been a lot of years since I heard any voices at all, and I'm truly grateful for that. But I had that change of attitude, you know? We tried to carry this message. Sometimes I forget the word try. I remember when I first got turned on to the book, I'm sober a couple years. You know, I put the fireman's hat on. I went through my evangelical stage. I went to preach to everybody. This is the way to do it. This is the only way to do it. When I closed the book, I went to backhand you with it to make sure it sunk in. I was sober about 5 or 6 years. I was in a meeting one time, and an old guy pulled me off to the side. And I really liked this guy. I really admired him. And he pulled me off to the side. He said, "You know what, Bobby?" He said, "You got a nice message. However, you come off offensive." He said, "Remember, it's not what you say, it's the way you say it." And you know what? I'm glad he told me the way he told me. Because if he would have cross-talked in the meeting, we would have had it out. Or if he would embarrass me. But he pulled me off to the side. He cared enough about me to straighten me out. But he did it in a loving way. Still with a firm foot up my back, which I needed. But he did it with love, which always makes it a lot easier, you know. And I've kind of mellowed out over the years. Not to the point where I compromise the message. I can never do that. See, I've compromised my entire life. I compromised, like I said, the values and ethics instilled in me. I compromised the values on my job. I did all that stuff to be liked. I no longer need that today, you know. I'm still going to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't need to blast you with it, but I can still share my experience with you. And I can't compromise because I would do you a disservice. Now, if I tell you that it doesn't matter if you don't like me, that's not true, too. I mean, that's a lie. I want everyone to like me, but if you don't, that's all right. I'm cool with that, you know. A lot of people in Philadelphia know me. A lot of people in Philadelphia may not like me, but a lot of people know me due to my experience and getting involved in the area, and that's okay. I'm okay with that today. I got involved in service. I learned about the traditions, and as I said before this meeting start, the traditions are to the group, but the steps are to the individual, and I love the traditions and the whole history about the traditions, and it's really neat stuff. I got involved in the area. My plan was I was going to be the youngest delegate ever to the General Service Conference. Look out for alcoholics with goals or ambition, you know. Who that youngest delegate was and how old that delegate was, I have no idea, but it was going to be me. I got involved, and in 1993, I was the alternate delegate for my area, Area 59. And I was also training to run. I went to run Boston through the marathon. And so I was training to do the marathon, and when one thing led to another, I just didn't feel good, so I went to the doctor. And I got diagnosed with lung cancer 12 years ago. And it just really just blew me out of the water. So I went to go get a second opinion, and it got confirmed. And I remember I got the news, you know, I didn't handle this well. You know, I'm on the pity pot, you know, I'm back to school, you know, things are going, you know, I thought I'm going places. And I remember my sponsor at that time, who would later die of lung cancer, and he wasn't diagnosed at this point, but he told me, he said, "Bobby, what the hell are you going to do about this?" So I went through treatment, and I bounced back, and then I got very sick to the point where, you know, I left work. I was laid up. I was in the hospital. I wound up surgery. I wound up getting the lower left lobe of my lung removed, and then I was laid up in my house for a while. And you know what? People came to my house to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm just not talking friends from my home group. I'm talking people that I may have met once or twice at the area assembly. People I didn't even know came to the house to carry the message. Now, you're looking at a liar, thief, and a cheat. I took from everyone. The only thing I gave was heartache and misery. And people I didn't even know were coming to carry the message. And you know what? It was just an incredible experience. Like, I knew my doctors did a pretty good job, and thank God it's a good health coverage. But it was the prayers in AA that saved me, no question about it, you know? I bounced back, and I've been fighting this off and on. I just had a little procedure not that long ago, and I kind of glow in the dark. But, you know, I'm doing all right now. I'm pretty good myself, you know? What's going on today? I got a great life today. I still work for the city 23 years. I'm no longer a police officer, though. I wound up getting severely injured a while back. Went back to grad school. Got rehired. Got my pension. Rehired by the city. Double dipping, which is very nice. If you could do it, I suggest you do it. And I got a good life today. You know, I owe it to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what? I talked about the mummers, and that's what I'm going to finish up. I always say this for the end, because most of the time people look at me like I got three heads. But there are a few people here from the Philadelphia area, so they kind of understand. The mummers, it's... I was at a midnight meeting, and I was talking to someone by the pool today. I love midnight meetings. Midnight meetings are either the most spiritual or the most bizarre. Very little middle ground. And I just love midnight meetings. And when I was working shift work, I used to do a lot of midnight meetings. And it was 15 years ago, I'm at this group, and I'm telling them my story. And a kid came up to me afterwards. He said, Bobby, would you be interested in marching in the Mummers Parade this year? Now I'm a lifelong mummer, but I couldn't march for a few years, my first couple years sober. I said, no, I can't do that. People, places, and things. He said, you don't understand. He said, we got a group of sober mummers. That's an oxymoron, sober mummers. The Mummers is a parade in Philadelphia on January 1st. It's been around for hundreds of years. It got so nuts, though, in 1901, the city finally had to organize the mayhem. And it goes on Broad Street, and it's just a blast. What it is, it's like 30,000 men. It used to be all men. We now let women in. We are not politically correct, I'm sorry. Everything's fair game. It's a bunch of men in sequins, feathers, and makeup. And I've done my fifth step. I can tell you this stuff. Sequins, feathers, and makeup. We play instruments, and we make fun of everybody. It's a drunk fest. It's like a joint thing between the Mardi Gras and the Full Monty. It's a bliss. I even tell people, you know, with all due respect for those from New Orleans, today is Fat Tuesday. I think we make the the Mardi Gras look like a bunch of Mormons. It's just nuts. And we're out there, and it's just a hoot. So, but I got sober. I couldn't do that anymore. And so I got involved in this group called the 12 Steppers, a sober mummers brigade on New Year's Day in Philadelphia. Now, mummers, there's a little class to us. It goes back to antiquity. The Greek god of ridicule was Mummus, and that's where the word mummer is derived from. A little history with that. So for the last 14 years, this past New Year's, January 2005, was my 14th year up the street with the 12 Steppers, but it was my 36th parade. See, it was able, I can now do something that was a big part of my family. I can now do it sober. So I'm saying, if you can go up Broad Street, New Year's Day, sober, anything is possible. One of my favorite sayings in the big book is, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. If the newcomer could see no joy in our existence, they want absolutely nothing to do with us. Now, obviously, I just paraphrase that. Bill's much more eloquent than I'll ever be. But you catch the deal, man. Like here, there's a week-long, it's beautiful, paradise. You know, when Steve called me about 8 months ago, he said, Bobby, you want to come down to Club Med in February? I said, hold on. Philadelphia, February, Club Med? Sure, I'll come. It wasn't like a tough decision. But, you know, like I was talking to someone today, like when I was sitting poolside, no, we were in the chow hall looking out the window, and I saw the palm trees and the ocean and the blue water. I said, you know what, if I was at work, I would be in a dingy municipal building with no windows, and here I am looking at this, just for being sober, you know. It's a wonderful way of life. I started off by saying that I never felt a part of. I did everything. I compromised the principles and ethics and values that I had to feel a part of. I no longer do that. And I just thank Steve for the privilege of participating in AA meeting. That's all I got. Thanks.